nothing left. Ever since I was a child, I had the feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Become. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact right. And that is why you are here.
And before now, history. To the unknown future. This is Red Ice Radio. For the seeker.
I must strive to know.
Hello, friends, and welcome to all listeners from around the globe. It's always nice of you to tune in, and we are glad to be able to talk to you once again. I would like to say thank you for all the kind and encouraging email that we receive. We do the best we can to read and reply to as much of it as possible. We encourage you to have a good look around at our websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com, for much more of what we do. We have more radio, news, videos, newsletter, RSS feeds, FAQs, mobile sites and apps, links to our social media channels, and much more. We work really hard to provide you with this service of bringing research, thoughts and opinions to one place. Do we agree with it all? Absolutely not. Do we expect you to believe it all? I hope no one does. Have we covered it all? Not even close. Do we think that you can learn something from most? Yes, absolutely, even if this is learning that you do not agree. The idea is that you continue to listen, watch and read, continue to learn, evolve and grow, and consequently focus and sharpen your own opinions and ideas. Take what you can, leave the rest, and move on. If you understand this process and value what we do, please consider signing up for a membership and get full access to our archives to learn even more. All right, let's move on now to the program. We are spending 1 hour together with Greg Braden today. He is known as a pioneer in bridging science and spirituality. For more than 27 years, Greg has explored high mountain villages, remote monasteries, and forgotten texts to merge their timeless secrets. His discoveries inspired books such as The God Code, The Divine Matrix, Fractal Time, and his newest, Deep Truth. He'll explain how our modern worldview has brought us to a crisis in thinking which threatens our lives today. He says most of the world's problems stem from a world based upon the false assumptions of an incomplete science. He will identify the five key false assumptions science has made and talk about new discoveries that can solve problems. All right, welcome back to Red Ice Radio, Greg. Good to talk to you again. It's been a few years, but it's good to have you back.
Oh, Henrik, it is so great to hear your voice. It has been a few years, and this is the first time we've spoken in 2013, now that 2012 is behind us. So I'm really happy to be with you and with all of our family, and you're part of the world today. Thank you for having me back.
Excellent. Well, you brought up 2012. It's actually one thing I did want to ask you about before we get in talking about your new book. We made it through. Any thoughts on it before we leave that topic, while others seem to move on to new dates, as it now seems?
Well, you know, it's interesting. January, just a few weeks ago, I did my first radio interviews for the new year. And one of the questions that was asked to me, they said, well, Greg, 2012 is over. Now what are we going to talk about? And yeah. I said, precisely. You know, it was so interesting to me, the significance that was placed on a specific date within the year 2012, on December 21st. And I actually spent the last 3 weeks of the year, 2012, in the Yucatan Peninsula, in the Mayan temple sites, working with the Mayan elders and with the tour groups that were coming down to to celebrate what was in fact the end of a cycle of time, the Mayan cycle of 5,125 years. Began August 11th, 3114 BC, completed on December 21st with the solstice. And that has been known and anticipated and expected for a very long time. And to the Mayan people themselves, they were in awe at the significance that the rest of the world, and especially the media, was placing upon the date that for them was another date on the calendar. It was a joyous date because it brings to the end the completion of one cycle and the beginning of the next. But, Henrik, I have to tell you, they never associated the bad things with that date that so much of the media tried to project.
Mm-hmm.
They never associated the, you know, earthquakes, floods, you know, the end of the world or anything like that. It was the end of a cycle, and by definition, the beginning of the next, and that was where their joy came from. So while they were really happy to have so many people visiting their part of the world and have the eyes of the world focused on their culture and their tradition, they were surprised at the expectations that much of the Western world had placed upon that date in their calendar. So it was interesting for me to see that firsthand through the eyes of the Mayan elders.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that from the Mayans, it was less about a single date. The date marked the end of the cycle, but it was more about a window of time, actually a 36-year-long window that we are still in between the year 1980 and the year 2016. Between the end of one cycle and the beginning of next, there's always a transition period or a little buffer, we can think of it that way, where the two cycles mesh. And it was about that window of time. The Mayans told us that we could expect great changes in our world, which I think we're seeing now. And they were absolutely certain that during that 36-year-long window, we would see the changes because they always happen. And they always happen because they're based upon Earth's location in space, at the change of Earth's location in space, the tilt, the angle, the orbit, and the wobble that changes ever so slightly our relationship to the sun, to the center of our Milky Way, and other stars. But it's this relationship to the sun that our own science now is bearing out that changes the patterns of climate on the Earth. And when the climate changes in the big picture, it changes the weather on the local scale. It changes when it's hot, when it's cold, when it rains, and when it snows, how cold it gets, how warm it gets. That changes when and how we're able to grow the food that we all rely upon, and those changes are what trigger the big shifts within people. How do we treat one another? How do we work together, or do we work together when we go through those kinds of cyclic changes? So it was because of their understanding of the cycles that the Mayan elders knew that humankind would have to make some choices in this 36-year-long window. And that is true. They never expected a lot of bad things to happen on one day, on the solstice, that many of the documentaries and the cable channels presented very authoritative documentaries with beautiful graphics, frightening a lot of people, in my opinion, for reasons that were unnecessary.
Yeah.
But that's a long answer to a short question, and thank you for beginning with that.
Oh, sure. No, you bet. It's good to kind of get that out there, if you will. I mean, these are cycles that have been ongoing for millions of years on this planet. It's I think, we in our current state that are more or less disconnected to them. But what do you think we're in for as a new cycle begins here, then, you know, coming shortly? What do you think?
Well, you know, it's a big question. I think we're in for exactly what we're experiencing right now because we are in the cycles. And I think a lot of it, our experience is determined, Henrik, by our perspective. How do we see the changes? Do we see the collapse of global economies, for example, as completely isolated from the shifts in climate, as completely isolated from the depletion of vital resources and the disappearance of the availability of fresh water in places that is increasing throughout the world? Those kinds of issues, do we see those things as isolated, or do we see them within the context of a bigger picture of change? And, you know, one thing the Mayans said to me, this is very interesting. They had a name for the last few years of this great cycle of time. The big cycle is called a world age, a great world age. And each world age is 5,125 years long, exactly 1,874 days long. And they broke that large cycle into smaller cycles. The last portion of the cycle is a 22-year-long cycle that began in August 1st of 1990. And they have a name for it, and the name is Pachacuti. Pachacuti, two words. Pacha is the indigenous word. I'm sorry, not the Mayan. I'm speaking about the Andeans right now. Mm-hmm. I apologize. These are the Andeans in southern Peru. The Andeans called this cycle Pachacuti. Pacha is the Andean word for cycle, and Kuti is the Andean word for the turning. So they, in their tradition, knew that we were living the last years of the turning of a great cycle. Began August 1st, 1990. It ended August 1st in the year of 2012. So although it was a different date, it was the same year that the Andeans of southern Peru identified as the end of their cycle. So by their definition, by the time December 21st arrived, we were already living in a new cycle, in a new age, and they have a name for the age, and the name is the reason that I'm sharing this story, and I think our listeners will love this. The Andeans, the Quero, Q-U-E-R-O, the Quero elders of southern Peru, call the name of the cycle that we are now in the age of meeting ourselves again. Mm-hmm. The age of meeting ourselves again. And I think it's interesting because it alludes to the fact that the experiences are based in cycles. We've been here before. And because they're cyclic, it tells us what we can truly expect. And as we expect, or as we're now experiencing, what the elders expected, the subtle changes in the planet in terms of climate, weather, and things like that, it triggers big changes within us and the way we think of ourselves and our relationship to the Earth. And it forces us to make the choice, and we are now in the place where we must make the choice. Do we cooperate and work together to adapt to the cyclic changes that are rare? No one living today remembers the last time this happened, for sure. Rare changes. Or do we fall into the old patterns based in the old beliefs that we are separate from the Earth, separate from one another, and that nature is based on this model of competition and fight one another as we go through the cycles. So the way we answer that question, I believe, is laying the foundation for what we can expect to happen in our lives and our world. And it's playing out on very big levels. Henrik, it's playing out in terms of how we solve the issues of the global economy. That economy, by the way, is based in the old model of survival of the strongest. It's an old Darwinian idea that we now know is a false idea. The new science, the best science of the 21st century, has now redefined the models of nature. And what they're saying is very prestigious journals like New Scientist, based in the UK, and in Nature, based in the States. They're now telling us in no uncertain terms that nature, in fact, is based in a model of cooperation and mutual aid, not survival of the strongest that we believe for the last 150 years or so. And while we know that violent competition does happen in nature, we've all seen it, and we're seeing it within humankind as well, it's not the rule, it's not the model that nature is based upon. It is in response to specific conditions that we're seeing. So the more violent competition we see in nature and that we see within ourselves, it tells us how far we have strayed from the model of nature itself. And the question now that I think we're asking is, are we going to honor the deepest truths of the newest discoveries of science that tell us we in fact live in a world based upon cooperation and mutual aid, or are we going to fall prey to the old ideas of competition? The collapse of the economic system is a beautiful example of where that's playing out. What's happening, the big war that so many people feel is brewing in the Middle East between Iran and Israel is another example. I personally believe it's a war that never need happen. I believe it will not happen. I believe we will come close because we are basing our solutions upon the old idea. But I also believe, I'll just state this now at the beginning of this this conversation, I believe we're about to witness what many will see as a miracle, and it will come out in the situation now between Israel and Iran, the nuclear power, Israel's security, and all of those things. I believe, Henrik, we are about to see this generation right now, for the first time, the generation we're living in, for the first time in over 5,000 years of recorded human history, I believe that we're about to see this generation turn its back on the use of war to solve large-scale problems, and we will walk away from that war that many believe is so probable in the Middle East, and we're going to embrace the idea and the fact that nature is based upon this model of cooperation. And when that happens between Iran and Israel in the Middle East, that is the first domino to fall, and the other dominoes will fall in suit. War will be redefined. It will take on a new meaning in the 21st century. And I think it will no longer be the first choice to solve our large-scale problems between between large nations. So I think we are witnessing, and because we're in the midst of the miracle, and in the States, the media really isn't covering what's happening between those two countries and a lot of the issues, the way that the media is covering it in other parts of the world. So many of your listeners in Europe may actually be more in tune with some of the issues that we're talking about than many of our listeners that are here stateside, unless those listeners are really seeking out that information through alternative forms of media.
Well, I believe you're right when you talk about the mass media mediums that we've seen for so many years. I believe that they're also part of an old structure, if you will, that is built on unsound principles, and therefore it's not increasing, and people are not going there to get their answers anymore. But maybe we just can talk a little bit more about that, on how you see that happening. Are you talking about soldiers then, young soldiers who are part of this, just basically laying down their arms or walking away, or what are you talking about when a miracle is going to happen?
Well, I think we're seeing it on many levels. We've already seen this happen in instances where the military in a country refuses the orders to turn on their own people. We've seen that.
Sure, yeah.
And I think we're seeing it. I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing publicly. If we search out through the beyond the mainstream media into the inner workings of what's happening between the nations, I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing behind the scenes and what I'm seeing publicly. It was really interesting, Henrik. I was at a conference. I was speaking at a conference in Mexico in early in the spring of last year, of 2012. And the conference ended up being like a little United Nations. There were people at this conference from 17 different nations in the world. And when I asked some questions to the audience from the stage, what I found was that of those 17 nations, 11 of those nations, the highest leaders of those nations were undergoing the elections before the end of 2012 in 11 of the leading nations of the earth. And certainly the United States was a big part of that. Israel was a big part of that. Mexico itself was a big part of that. And what it said was that there was the opportunity for a tremendous shift in thinking in terms of how the most powerful nations on the earth go about solving their problems. Now I'm going to go back to the very beginning of our conversation. The way that we solve our problems as individuals in our own lives, in our personal relationships, our friends, family, marriage, careers, and the way we solve our problems between nations, although the scales are very different, the way we go about it is very similar. And that is that we tend to solve our problems by the way that we see and define our relationship to ourselves, to the world, to one another, to our past, and even to nature itself, the lens through which we see ourselves and our relationship to the world. And that's important to know, because in recent history of our civilization, the last 100, 150 years or so of modern civilization, we have relied upon science to tell us about those relationships. We rely subconsciously sometimes and often on a very conscious level. If you ask people, who are you? Where do we come from? How do we get here? How do things work? More often than not, they will cite their references to scientific discoveries to answer those questions. Well, I was trained as a scientist, and I think science is good. And I also know that science, number one, is incomplete. Science does not have all the answers. And number two, science can only serve us to the degree that we keep science honest. And here's what I mean by that. Science was designed as a method of exploration, a way to tell us about the very things we're asking, about our relationship to the world and ourselves. And science is only as current as we allow it to be. Science is designed to be constantly updated with new material, new information, when new discoveries are made and when those discoveries are confirmed. It's what we call the peer review process. So it's not enough to make the discovery. The discovery must be made, and then it must be checked out by our peers, circulating the papers, the research papers and discoveries. And when a consensus is agreed upon that paper describes something that our peers agree is true, then we say it is a fact. And unless we update our scientific story with those facts as they come to light, science becomes obsolete. And that's the problem that we find ourselves in today. Science has been hijacked in many respects by industry, by money, by ego, by habit. And much of the scientific story that we rely upon to tell us who we are in the world and to help us solve our problems, we now know that story is obsolete. We know it's obsolete, Henrik, because new discoveries are overturning 150 years of what we believe to be true about ourselves and our relationship to the world and one another and how we solve our problems. Now, I would think that would be the good news. People would be so happy to hear those new discoveries and to incorporate them in their lives. And I've written a new book about that. The book is entitled Deep Truth, Igniting the Memory of Our Origin, History, Destiny, and Fate. And one of the first things I found as I began to tour the world with this book is that there is a reluctance, and in many cases, I'll just be honest, in many cases it is a resistance in the mainstream to share these new discoveries in mainstream media, mainstream documentaries, mainstream television programs, mainstream classrooms, public textbooks. There's a reluctance to share the new discoveries.
Sure.
And of all of the implications, that would be important at any time, but the big implication that relates to this conversation we're having now is that our young people, and in many instances, the power structures that be, our government leaders,
sure,
government organizations, they are now trying to solve the new problems, the big issues, the collapse of the global economy, how we deal with climate change, how we deal with the disappearance of vital resources, how we solve that problem in the Middle East. They're trying to solve that problem through the thinking that is based in a lens of scientific story that is no longer true. Because the new discoveries are telling us very, very, very clearly now that we are deeply connected to our bodies. For example, where the old belief was that we're separate from our bodies, the new discoveries tell us that we are deeply enmeshed with the systems of the earth. The old science told us we were separate from the earth. The new discoveries are telling us that nature is based upon this model of cooperation and mutual aid, where the old scientific beliefs were that nature is based in this model of violent competition. So we are now at this critical juncture, what many are calling the time of a perfect storm, where the conditions in the world and in our lives are forcing us to make a choice as to whether or not we embrace the new discoveries. And I don't know if we will or we will not, because the choices are being made right now. But my sense is that that we are slowly, we are embracing the new discoveries, and this now comes back to the conversation about what's happening in the Middle East. This is one of the places where the new leaders in the most powerful nations on the earth that are making the big choices between war and peace, they are slowly beginning to embrace the facts of the best science of our time, and then they're incorporating those facts into the way they solve the problems. And that's one of the reasons I'm very encouraged by what I'm seeing in the Middle East. For example, Israel had their elections. Netanyahu was reelected. People said, we want you as a leader. However, we want you to lead differently. That's very interesting. They like him as a leader. They said, we don't like the ideas that you have about war. And so he now is in this position where he's being asked by the people that put him back in power to change the way he thinks of himself and his nation in relationship to war, to solving the problems, because the people are embracing these new facts. And I think it's a very, very interesting place. But a long answer to a short question, this is one of the reasons I'm so encouraged by 2013 and where we are now, and I think we're going to see the world embrace these ideas, Henrik. And it may not, I don't know if the world is going to come out and say, hey, you know, these are the new ideas of science, let's go with them. I don't know that it's going to be that obvious.
It probably doesn't have, when does ever anything happen that quick? It's a slow process, usually anyway, but you might be right. If there is enough incentive, if there's enough chaos and mayhem, unfortunately, in the world, which is the upside to all of that, then at those points, that's when people actually look at towards new ideas, of course. But tell us a little bit more about the new discoveries and where you've encountered these. Tell us what they are, a little bit more about them. Curious.
Sure. And, well, I'm just going to back up a little bit. I believe the changes are happening slowly in some respects on a broad scale. I used to work for when I was working in the corporations, I had a boss that used to tell me that for our corporation to change, he said it would never change on a day. He said it was like a big ship going through the ocean, and when a ship begins to turn around and go back to where it came from, it can't turn quickly. It makes a big, wide turn gradually and begins heading back.
And Greg, sorry to interrupt, but and also tie into this, the bigger the ship is, the more difficult it will be to turn around it quickly. So if we look at things like global politics and major companies, it'll take longer time, right?
Well, yes, in some respects. And here's the flip side. The choices are being made, and the decisions must be made for some of these issues that we've just mentioned within the next 60 to 90 days. Are we going to have that war in the Middle East? That decision is being made within the next 60 to 90 days. How will the world deal with climate change between the major nations, and what are the facts of the climate change? We can talk about some of that here in this program. But those decisions are being made. The economic system can't afford to wait years before we understand the sustainable forms of economy that must be put in place rather than fall back on the unsustainable ideas, unsustainable foundation that the economy now is collapsing upon. So those kinds of situations, it may be that we find ourselves in converging simultaneous crises that must be solved so quickly it will force us to make these choices and decisions and embrace the new ideas much quicker than we've ever been asked to do in the past. And this leads, I think, Henrik, to what is even maybe the greatest crisis that very few people are talking about. And I believe it is the crisis that must be understood before we can solve the other problems, and that is a crisis in thinking. Crisis in thinking. Mm-hmm. Before, the science is there, the technology is there, the answers to all the solutions, the big problems in our world already exist. That what stands between a transformed world today and all of those solutions being implemented is the thinking. And we're asking ourselves to do something truly extraordinary. We're asking ourselves as individuals, as communities, as societies, as a civilization, as nations, as a planet, to change the way we think faster and in a more radical way than we've ever been asked to do before in order to meet the needs of the crises that are on our doorstep. Now, I used to have an aversion to the word crisis. I remember when I was growing up as a kid back in the 1950s, 1960s, every time you heard the word crisis, you know, it wasn't good. It was the Cuban Missile Crisis or the crisis of the Cold War, you know, or something like that. But in later years, I've actually come to appreciate the word crisis tremendously, and I'm going to share why for this reason. When a crisis is present, it means we still have time to fix the problem. When a crisis is present, we still have time to look at the facts, to address the needs that are calling upon us for more attention. When the crisis is over, there's no you can't fix it anymore. When the crisis is over, it means whatever's going to happen has already happened. So the fact that we are in the midst of so many crises that are still present, climate change, the way we solve our big problems, war or peace, in the Middle East is a big place where that's coming up. The economic system, these are three major converging crises. They're still present. We still have time to do something about them, and I think that's the good news. Biologists tell us the crisis is the catalyst for evolution, the crisis is the catalyst for transformation. And if that is the case, then we have these three big opportunities for evolution and for transformation on our doorstep right now. Are we going to resort to war in the Middle East to solve the problems? Are we going to use the old models of economy to try to patch up the global issues that now face all of us? And climate change is with us. It's not that it's going to happen, it is happening. Do we recognize the facts of the climate change and deal with them in an honest, truthful manner, or do we allow economy, politics, money, and ego to hijack the best science of our day so that we chase the false promises that are being made by many people about what to do with climate change? So all of those issues are here right now, and it all comes back, and I want to talk about the discoveries that I've shared in the new book that give us reasons to think differently about all those problems.
I wanted to ask you before we proceed here as well, how you, Greg, see this in terms of how to stay, I guess, vigilant in a time when also the very same old power controllers, as you've been mentioning here, are, I believe, very aware of how to use any crisis to continue to stay in power and remain in control. It's also that dilemma of when you're asked to change your thinking and act drastically and quickly, you have a potential that, okay, do you know then what the decision really are when we haven't spent a great deal of time on it, and hence we might be fooled into doing something that still is beneficial to the same old structure, if you're following me, Greg.
Sure, sure. And, you know, this is, I think, it's part of the crisis in thinking. When we see a problem in the world, and a big problem, the knee-jerk reaction is we've got to act. We've got to do something and do it quickly. And this is actually the crux of this most recent book, Deep Truth. My question as a scientist, I was trained as a scientist, and my question is, how can we possibly act and make some of the greatest decisions of our lifetime, and certainly for this time in human existence? I mean, these are huge choices, huge decisions that we're being asked to make about climate change and global economics that are going to affect the generations to come and the existence of our very species.
Yeah.
How can we make those choices until we have answered the deepest questions of our very existence? And our science has done that. We have trusted science for the last 150 years to answer the big questions about who we are, where we come from, how things work in the world, what is our relationship to ourselves, to our past, to the future. Science has done that. And what has happened is many people simply don't like the answer that science has come up with. So it is being discounted and ignored. So my even bigger question is, how can we solve the greatest issues of our time if we're not even honest with ourselves about the issues and about what science has told us. And this comes down to the crisis in thinking. So in the book, Deep Truth, what I've done is I've identified a number of assumptions that science has made over the last 150 or so years about us and how things work in the world. The assumptions that we now know are no longer true, and I've identified the new discoveries that tell us that those assumptions are no longer true. And it's these discoveries that give us the new and empowering lens through which to see ourselves and our relationship to the world and solve the problems. So what I'd like to do, Henrik, if I could I identify five key assumptions?
Please do.
That science has made. Now, I don't know how it is in throughout the European communities, but I can say that in the United States, Canada, for example, in the public schools, in the classrooms, every teacher in a public school is bound by a covenant, by an agreement with the state or the province within which they teach. A teacher can only share in the classroom the science that has been approved by the school board and the curricula that has been approved by the school board. And if the school board does not approve the curricula that based in the new science, then the teacher cannot share that in the classroom. They are required by law to teach the obsolete science. How does that work?
Same thing in Europe, as far as I'm concerned, Greg. I haven't heard any other country that has it differently.
Well, I know in private schools, they're not bound by this agreement. So the net result is unless the school board, and there are a lot of politics, as we all know, are involved in the school boards, unless they embrace the new science, peer-reviewed scientific facts, unless they embrace and teach those in the classroom, we are teaching our young people, the entire generation, science that is based upon many of the false assumptions that I'm about to share here and others, and we're asking our young people to solve the problems that we're leaving to them through the same thinking of unsustainable principles that led to the problems to begin with. And I'm not suggesting, I want to be really clear on two points, I'm not suggesting that we throw out all of the teachings that we have now. What I am suggesting is that we honor our young people, and maybe alongside the existing curricula, we also share the new discoveries. Give our young people all of the facts, all the data, and say this is what we know to be true right now so that they have the full toolkit available to them when they go to solve the problems that we're leaving behind. And I also want to be very, very clear about the teachers. When I talk about the reluctance in the classroom of teachers, or the resistance to teach these assumptions, it's not the teacher's fault, because the teachers in public schools are bound by the agreements with the school boards. And what I'm finding is many teachers are finding very creative ways to let their students know that there's a bigger story than what they're being allowed to give in the classroom. And they can give the young people the references so they can explore them on their own through the internet and through the sources that are available to them. So I'm not disrespecting the teachers in any way. I'm actually very grateful for the job that the teachers do and the creative ways that they're attempting to share these discoveries in the classroom. So very quickly, what I'd like to do is this. There are a number of key assumptions that we now know are false. In the new book, I've identified five of them. I'm going to describe them, and then I'll share the new discoveries that tell us why these assumptions we know are false.
Okay, great.
The first assumption, probably to no one's surprise, is based on the work of Charles Darwin and his beliefs of evolution. Darwin suggested in his theories of evolution, introduced in 1859 through his book The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, Darwin suggested that life itself is based in these principles of evolution, and that evolution explains the origin of life and the origin of human life.
Mm-hmm.
He believed that the two were interrelated. The problem is the best science of our time, the physical discoveries and now the new discoveries in DNA and genetics, simply do not support Darwin's assumption. Now, I have to be very clear. I'm a geologist, an earth scientist by degree, and I have seen evolution in the fossil record. And we do see it for some forms of life, plants and some forms of animals. The new discoveries, however, do not support evolution as being the sole explanation for human origins. And the DNA is showing us that something else happened that cannot be explained through evolution that led to us as we are today. So Darwin's idea of evolution does not explain human origins, and it is being taught as a fact in the classroom today as if it did. That's the first false assumption. The second one is with regard to civilization itself. We're being led to believe, when I was in school back in the 60s and 70s, our young people there are being told the same thing, that civilization began approximately 5,000 years ago, maybe 5,500 years ago, in the Mesopotamian Valley, ancient Sumeria, that civilization is more or less linear, that has begun in a primitive state and evolved to the sophistication that we see today, and it's a one-time deal. The problem with that is that the evidence, peer-reviewed scientific evidence, doesn't support that assumption. We now have evidence of advanced technological civilizations over twice as old is what we're led to believe today, pushing the date of civilization back into the end of the last ice age, around 12 to 13,000 years ago. And the evidence doesn't exist only in one place. It's in multiple places, leading us now to believe that civilization is cyclic rather than linear. And this is exactly what our indigenous ancestors have always told us. I personally have had the opportunity to document some of these civilizations. One is in northern Peru, about 4 hours north of Lima, Peru, an area that is called Caral, C-A-R-A-L, that is now scientifically accepted as being the oldest civilization, the oldest advanced civilization in all of the Americas, older than anything in Canada, the United States, Mexico, anything in South America except Caral. It's older than the Maya, older than the Aztec, older than the Olmec, older than the Toltec. It's a 150-acre site. It's huge. Three massive circular plazas, five massive pyramids, with people had access to an information system so advanced it wasn't even recognized until Yale University decoded the way that the information was being stored. And this is not being taught in the classrooms and textbooks today. We're told that civilization began 5,000 years ago. That's when this one ended, and it began about 2,000 years before that. The oldest site now accepted anywhere in the world, I'll just cut to the bottom line here, sure, cut to the space, is Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, a mysterious site that is now being dated between 12 and 13,000 years before present. It's called an anomaly. It shouldn't exist. But there are other sites in India, in Egypt, in Turkey, in South America, and the fact that there are so many that of so many different ages are now opening the door to the fact of the cycles of civilization. So we know that this assumption that civilization is about 5,000 years old, we know that that is false, and yet it's being taught as a fact in the classroom.
Yeah.
Number three and number four are actually related, false assumptions, number three and number four. In physics, we're being taught that consciousness is somehow separate from our physical world, number three, and number four, that the space between physical things is empty. And the problem with that is that our own physicists are telling us there is no empty space in nature. There are forms of energy that fill all space that we're only beginning to recognize because our equipment was not designed to detect these forms of energy. And some of the leading scientists, Professor John Wheeler, for example, from Princeton University, who was a colleague and a friend of Albert Einstein's, and John Wheeler only died a few years ago. He died in 2008. He was a leading proponent that said very vocally, you cannot separate consciousness from our everyday world. And the moment that you do, you lead us down a path of incomplete understanding. The reason we have yet to find this elusive, unified field theory that ties all of the physics together is because we've written out of the equations the very thing that unifies those understandings, and that is consciousness itself. So that's three and four. Number five, the fifth false assumption. It's the last on this list. It may be the most important in terms of this conversation today. We've already alluded to it. And it is another Darwinian assumption. Darwin stated in 1859, in the language, his own language, he said that nature is based upon what he called survival of the strongest. Now, it was later interpreted, and other authors called it survival of the fittest. But Darwin himself called this survival of the strongest. Darwin believed that nature was based upon struggle, and he believed that there were always what he called races. This is the term he used in 1859, races of beings that would win out over others in the struggle. So through this lens, this was Darwin's lens of belief, everything that he saw in his observations, he interpreted through the eyes of struggle and through the eyes of one race being superior over the others, whether he was talking about birds or ants or humans. And this is my, I have a lot of respect for Darwin as a scientist. I think he was a good scientist. And Darwin attempted to do something in his day that had never been done before. Before 1859, the answers to all the big questions about life, where do we come from, how do we get here, how does life work, you know, how do we solve our problems, they were all answered in the religious and spiritual communities, largely by the church, by the Catholic Church in the mid-1800s. Darwin attempted, through the language of science, as he knew it in his time, to take a step away from the church answering all the questions and to put humankind on a path toward scientifically answering the questions, taking religion out and the dogma and the rules of religion out of the answer. And Darwin said very clearly in his book, in his own words, he said, this is only the first step. And he expected his theories would fall. He said, when new discoveries tell us that my theories no longer hold up, they will collapse and those new discoveries will replace them. So Darwin allowed for his theories to fall. It's pop science, popular science today, that refuses to allow Darwin's theories to fall. And this idea of nature being based in survival of the strongest is a perfect example. So Darwin, in my estimation, where Darwin made the mistake, is he believed that what he saw happening with some forms of life in a moment in time, in one place in the world, was a small example of principle that would apply to all life everywhere, all the time, including humans. And I think that's where, if we can say he went wrong somewhere, that's where he went wrong. So the best science of our time, as we mentioned earlier in this program, is telling us very clearly that nature is based upon this model of cooperation and what biologists call mutual aid. And that changes everything. However, this principle is not being taught in the classrooms. We have an entire generation of young people that now believe that we live in a world of scarcity, where there is one big pie, if you will, in the world, and that we must fight for our slice of that pie. We're being led to believe that we live in a world that's characterized in the West as dog eat dog. And that thinking plays out in our lives, our everyday lives, in terms of the way we treat our siblings, how we deal with the problem, the most intimate relationships, our marriages, our friendships, how we deal with our coworkers. It's playing out in communities in terms of as water becomes scarce because of the changes we're going through and our ability to grow food. We're being asked whether or not we embrace this false assumption of survival of the strongest and every person out for themselves, or the idea of cooperation, and that through cooperation, everyone benefits to a greater degree and we're better off when we work together to solve our problems. And now it's playing out on the national scene as well. So that, again, was a long answer to a short question, but I wanted to lay this out, Henrik, so we can tie into these ideas. These are the ideas I am talking about on the tours and the live events that I share throughout the world, and through a very visual program, we explore every one of these ideas in the real world. What does this stuff mean to us today? Why is it important that we overturn Darwin's ideas from 150 years ago? And what is the new science telling us? Because unless we are honest with ourselves, how can we possibly solve the greatest problems that have led to the greatest crises of our existence? So that's why I'm very passionate about this material.
Very good. We're going to talk a little bit about where you'll be in Europe shortly here. But one quick thing I want to run by you before we get there, though. The energy crisis as well is going to be one of the biggest issues as well today. The assumption that nuclear energy and fossil fuels is the only way we can do business. This must be maybe one of the assumptions that connected to what you mentioned earlier, that there's nothing about empty space between the atoms. But do you think that energy could be part of this structure of assumptions as well, Greg? And if we can move on from there, a lot of things would fall into place.
Sure. You mean the way where what we turn to get our energy? Is that what you're asking?
That's right. Yeah.
I believe it is. I think the first and most urgent place it's going to play out, and you're going to see this. The experts are telling us, the governments have told us, between now and the end of March, the decisions about what will happen between Israel and Iran will be made. So the urgency of that situation, I think, is probably the first place we're going to see it play out. Energy is a big place, because we are now just about 100 years into the use of fossil fuels, almost exclusively, for the energy, for the homes and the families of the people throughout the world, to heat our homes, to cool our homes, to cook our food. And we now know that that source of energy is based in unsustainable principles that are also not only unsustainable, they're harming us and our relationship to the environment. I'm going to be very honest about this. Well, let me ask, are you okay if I'm honest, truthful, and factual about my response? Is that...
We expect everyone to be, so okay. please go ahead.
Well, and I have to say this to our listeners, because my answer may not be the answer that many people want to hear or hoping to hear.
Well, so be it, you know.
So I'm going to preface this.
Sure.
Are there forms of energy that we can tap from the universe itself, what is called zero-point energy, free energy? The answer, I believe, is yes. I've worked as an engineer long enough, and I've seen demonstrations and models that tell us that form of energy exists. Are we going to see it implemented on a widespread commercial basis within the next 2 or 3 years to solve the big problems that we're looking at? Honestly, I think we're not at that place yet.
Yeah.
I think we're going to, this is like the big ship turning around. There are steps that are going to be happening in between. Are the steps the ultimate solution? No. Are the steps leading us closer to the solution? I believe the answer is yes. Are the steps better for us in the environment than what we're doing now? Absolutely. And one of those steps, there is a form of energy. I live in, my wife and I live in a rural community in northern New Mexico, not far from where the Manhattan Project happened in the mid-20th century, mm-hmm. World War II. And what a lot of people didn't know is that when the scientists learned to split the atom, and that happened, of course, in wartime, and so that was the lens through which the thinking was directed, and uranium was used to power the reactors because it had the byproducts that could be used in war. But there were other minerals that were discovered in the mid-20th century that would allow a reactor to work. But they cannot be used for weapons. They cannot be weaponized. They cannot melt down in a reactor the way a uranium reactor does right now. The byproducts can actually be recycled and used in the next cycle of the fuel, and the waste, rather than being 10 or 20,000 years for the waste to break down, it can happen in a matter of maybe 1 to 200 years. And that is a mineral that is called thorium. T-H-O-R-I-U-M, is element number 90 on the periodic table. There is a move now, and it's happening largely in, we're seeing in India. India already has thorium reactors that cannot melt down, so they cannot have a Fukushima-type event.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing it in China. We're seeing it in Russia as a way. Thorium is inexpensive. It's tremendously abundant in the Earth's crust, and I think we're going to see more of that to provide the energy for the electricity for the major nations of the world. And I also believe that there is a big move toward what is called LNG, liquefied natural gas. It is still a fossil fuel. However, it puts out less than one half of the pollutants that the coal and the oil-based fuels do today. And I think between maybe thorium and liquefied natural gas, to provide electricity for the power grids of the world, just those two solutions tremendously reverse the trajectory that we are on right now of throwing hundreds of thousands of tons of pollutants and particulates into the atmosphere, and the carbon dioxide is reduced tremendously. So are they the ultimate answer? No. Are they the stepping stone getting us there? Realistically, behind the scenes, this is where I'm seeing the industry go, and the politics are supporting these movements right now.
Hmm.
So it's a step in the right direction. It's not the ultimate answer. And I believe we will see a time where the free or the zero-point energy becomes available. Right now, I don't see we have to have the change in the thinking. It's the crisis in thinking. And the thinking right now isn't there, and the technology is still evolving the thinking is evolving to put make that technology a priority, and I think that has to happen first.
Yeah,
that's where I think we're going to see it in the next 2 or 3 years. We're seeing these new forms of energy come online.
Definitely. I hope you're right, Greg. Yeah, and I just want to mention here as well before we wrap things up, of course, that the new book you can read more about is Deep Truth, Igniting the Memory of Our Origin, History, Destiny, and Fate. And Greg, as well, tell us, our listeners, where they can go, of course, if they want to pick up a copy. And also tell us some of the dates and places that you'll visit soon in Europe before we let you go.
Sure, sure. Well, Henrik, I want to thank you for your support over the years. Our interviews maybe are too few and far between. Maybe we could look into doing more of these.
Would love to do it, Greg. Yeah.
I so appreciate your vision, your dedication, your perseverance to this kind of programming as a forum to have these conversations that are so critical to inform people in a responsible, honest, and truthful and factual way. And I appreciate the opportunity to do that today.
Thanks, Greg.
I am coming to Europe briefly next month in March. I will be in Rimini, Italy, for a weekend program, Friday, Saturday, March 15th and 16th. I will be in Copenhagen for an evening intensive, a very packed evening intensive, March 19th. I will be in Basel, Switzerland, Friday, Saturday, March 22nd and 23rd. The programs that I'm offering are multimedia. They are packed with the images that support the facts, that make it both interesting, make it a lot of fun, fascinating. And what I can't put into the images is the direct experience of the inner work that science, the best science of today, and the traditions of our past, the wisdom traditions, have always told us is a part of our transformation. And that is what is called the coherence between the heart and the brain. How do we create that coherence within us? Because when we do, it facilitates the cooperation in our communities, in our families, and on a large enough scale, the science tells us, it actually facilitates cooperation between nations. So if we ever needed a time to share these discoveries and create that coherence that facilitates mutual aid and cooperation, Henrik, I can't think of a better time than right now to do that. And all of that will be in every one of these programs that I share with our family in Europe when I'm there briefly next month.
Very good. And give us a website as well. We can read more about these dates.
Sure. You know, my personal website's www.gregbraden.com, GREGGBRADEN.com. It's supported by our publisher, Hay House. So it's a very dynamic, rather than a static website being updated all the time. And the schedules, all the way into 2014, you can see where I will be anywhere in the world up until the early months of 2014, a year from now, and the dates that I've just described and the details of the venues, the locations, all of that are available there as well.
Thanks for your time today, Greg. I hope you enjoy your time in visiting Europe.
I look forward to it tremendously, and I want to thank you again for our time today. And I'm going to send my very best to all of our friends and family in the airwaves, wherever you are hearing this. I want to thank you all, every one of you, each of you, for all you're doing every day to live this transition and to make this world a better place. Thank you all so much.
Well, there you have it, my friends. That's our program for today. We have some more in the pipeline for you coming soon, of course. Dan Johnson on the NDAA, Josh Reeves on the Lost Secrets of Ancient America, and then we have Suzanne Posel from Occupy Corporatism joining us for discussion. Don't miss Radio 314 with Lana, our latest addition to Red Eyes Creations. Some of our recent programs have been with Mike Siebert on asset forfeiture, endangered rights, and judicial tyranny. Also, Chris Augustine on all things UFO and alien-related. Most recently, Kelly Rosano on astrological transits for 2013. We'll wrap up for this time, but if you like what we do and want to hear more, please consider signing up for a membership at redeyesmembers.com and get full access to our archives. In this world of increased pressure and polarization, I hope you stay cool, remain sane, and that you'll tune in again when we're back with more in just a few days.